Confuse him with Bill.
Going to open a committee. I don't know which one. I'm just going to open one. Oh, let's see. House Committee on Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities. Today's May 19th, 2009. It is 8:05, sorry, folks. We are going to, I think we'll, since we have other members that'll be filtering in, go ahead and get started on our public hearing on Senate Bill 409A. We have a member here to discuss it as well.
Thank you.
So I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 409A and ask my good friend Senator Fred Girod to come up and talk to us about it.
J7-1, I've got that. So this one here.
Oh, I haven't got dash one.
Chair Clem, the rest of the committee, I just want you to know that I really enjoy being back in the House. My heart's always over here. This is a fun place to be as compared to the Senate.
Oh, he could have stayed. There was no reason.
It's the fun place to stay.
It is. It's more fun over here.
More exciting.
Anyway, for the record, I'm Senator Fred Girod. I represent Senate District 9, which includes three counties, Lynn, Marion, and Clackamas, as well as 18 small cities. Senate Bill 409 seeks to allow blackberry growers cooperatives to negotiate prices directly with processors. Currently, statute allows this type of negotiation for producers of ryegrass, fescue seed, as well as Oregon seafood commodity dealers. The need for such a bill was presented to me in the interim by the Blackberry Bargaining Association. This association represents growers of marionberries, blackberries, boysenberries, sylvanberries, and potata, to name a few. Senate Bill 409A is the end result of a cooperative effort among myself, the Blackberry Bargaining Association, and the Oregon Department of Agriculture. A few quick facts. In 2007, there was 7,100 acres of blackberries harvested in Oregon with a yield per acre of 8,300 pounds. This amounts to a total value of $28 million. Oregon ranks number one among all states in the production of blackberries. Colleagues, the reason that this will work is it's a very small commodity in distribution, and it allows them to go to the processors and negotiate a base price. It's kind of a high-risk crop to be to produce, and so by doing this, the producer is assured of a price, and the supply, commodity, or the canneries are assured of a supply. So it's a good thing for everybody. There's been very little opposition. I'm going to turn it over to my colleagues that have been working on this, Roger Beyer and the Blackberry Association. But if you have any questions, I probably don't know the answer. They probably do. And once again, it's always great to be over here where humor kind of rates high on the graft.
Okay, any questions for our colleague from the slightly lower elevation-wise chamber from what we understand from the flooding? Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my biggest concern, these must be not a commodity that has somebody trying to take it over. I mean, I worry that you start getting a producer and a couple berry guys, and they set the market for themselves, and everybody else has to fall in line. You know, cranberries, every once in a while, we get these conversations because you've got a producer like Ocean Spray that comes in, and so the people who are on the Ocean Spray group all do pretty well up and down because they moderate it, but the people who are outside of that have a real tough time at times getting into the market. So
I don't think so, but
okay.
That's a question I think you should ask the
okay.
producers, but that's not the intent of the bill by any stretch of the imagination.
I assume that, but it makes me nervous every once in a while.
Well, it's sort of like beer, you know. You got to make sure you get your full pint. So
that's
we
exactly.
make sure we get exactly what we want here.
Yes. Okay.
Rare. Okay. I think with that, we will let you get back to the business of the large office measuring.
Oh, hey, thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay. Little sign-up sheet around. Here we go. I'm going to call Brent Searle, Leonard Height, and Wayne Boschler up.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee, for the record, Brent Searle, Special Assistant to Director Katie Koba for the Department of Agriculture. I want to give you a brief framework of how this process works, what kind of the statutory background of it is, legal, and the intent and purpose. The first two paragraphs in my testimony really sum up this whole process, and I'll try to summarize the rest of it. But what we're creating here by law is called state action immunity. And one of the primary purposes of this process through legislative intervention is to allow the parties to voluntarily convene and be immune from antitrust laws. And they do that through the authority of a state agency, in this case Department of Agriculture, that oversees, supervises, and is actively involved in the process. And that is what gives the parties immunity from being prosecuted for antitrust. So that's why we're doing this legislatively. So as indicated in the second paragraph, there is basically five purposes that are accomplished here. One is the antitrust. Secondly, it enables the parties to collectively get together and share information about markets, inventory, what's going on. Gives everybody a voice in the process that wants to come to the table and talk about what's happening in this particular commodity area. Creates an opportunity that may not otherwise exist for the parties to do something collaboratively. And finally, it can help stabilize the price over time and take swings out of the market. And that's one of the biggest challenges in agriculture, those of you familiar with this, is those swings that go from year to year. And it's very hard, especially with crops like this that are very high investment, to have years where the prices just tank and to survive those lows and so forth. So part of the intent here is to try to stabilize that more over time. Partly what enables this process is what's called the Capra-Volstead Act. You may be familiar with this. This is the law at the federal level. It was passed in 1922 that allows farmers to form cooperatives. And we have a corresponding state law. And this is what gives the farmers antitrust protection, to be able to create co-ops, bargaining associations, and do certain things with their commodities, to give them a collective voice rather than individually facing large buyers in the marketplace and having no say in their product. And you're familiar with many of the co-ops we have in the state, Tillamook Creamery, Norpac, Pendleton Grain Growers, and so forth. We have a lot of grower cooperatives. And as a cooperative, or a bargaining cooperative in this case, they can meet individually without the state or department's intervention with any buyer they choose to do so and bargain over prices. They can do that right now. And the hazelnut growers do it that way. Some of the potato organizations in Eastern Oregon, Washington, Idaho do that. They bargain over prices that way. But they can only meet with one buyer at a time. So what this does is allow all the buyers that choose to come to the table collectively and sit down, antitrust protection, and go through a discussion about prices and issues. This process in Oregon, and it's quite unique, I don't know of any other state that's doing this to the extent we are, but in 2001, the grass seed industry requested this process so they could collectively sit down and bargain over prices. So the precedent for this is House Bill 3811 that was passed in 2001. We've been doing that for 9 years, bargaining over prices and supervising those in perennial ryegrass. We work very closely with the Attorney General in drafting the legislation and the rules for this, so to ensure that we had protections for the parties. From that time in 2003, the authority was extended at the request of the seafood industry, and we've supervised negotiations for Dungeness crab and pink shrimp. In 2005, the grass seed statute was extended to tall fescue and annual ryegrass, and we'll be doing tall fescue for the 2009 crop. So more commodities are looking at this as a way to try to create some stability and a different way of approaching pricing in today's very volatile markets. participation, just a few notes. It is voluntary. The way the bill is drafted, parties can choose to come or not. So there's no heavy-handedness in this from the department or the state. A buyer can choose to come. And on the grower side, they can choose to be members of the bargaining association or not. Those are voluntary choices. ODA does believe that this process has been beneficial. We haven't always reached a price agreement, but it does create a good forum for information sharing for the parties to be able to do things they otherwise couldn't in this kind of a forum. There are two clear doctrines that have to be established in the state law to meet antitrust protection, and the bill is drafted to do that. The first is it clearly has to articulate in statute what market activity is being displaced. In this case, it's competitive pricing and contract terms through a negotiated process, and that's spelled out in the statute. That's required. And secondly, it requires active supervision of a state agency. And apologies, I didn't number the pages, but it's the second one from the end. There's the requisite legislative authority and role of the department. There's six items there that articulate what the department has to do, again, to give the parties antitrust protection. And to sum it up, it's more than just rubber stamping whatever they negotiate and agree to. We have to be there present. We have to have minutes recorded. We have to approve or disapprove the prices ultimately that may be negotiated. So the state has to be the final approver of that price in order, again, to have antitrust immunity. We will adopt rules for this process, and that's where all the parties that may be affected or involved will come and help the department shape how this particular sector wants to function with the price negotiations. And every one of these is different. And I can tell you every year is different as we sit down and do these things. And so we'll work that out with the parties. And finally, this is a fee-for-service program. It's created that way in statute. And so by rule, we will set a fee with the parties. And so there's no or very minimal impact on the state budget. So I will conclude with that and be happy to try to respond to questions if you have any.
It was that figure.
When you have perishable products, you know, they're going to get blackberry, they're going to get ripe at a certain time frame. Is there any requirement as to when this takes place ahead of that period?
Yeah. Chair Clem, Representative Creer, that's a very good question. The timing is something that we would probably work out by rule for blackberries, and it is critical. I think you have to do it enough ahead of time that parties can make decisions. And just to use an example from the grass seed industry, we've steered the industry to having a preliminary price by October 1 of every year so that farmers can make planning decisions and dealers can make contract decisions. And then that price can be adjusted as we work through how that year goes and so forth. And the final price isn't set usually till the following August. But there has to be a price signal in the process, at least in that case, this contracted proprietary product. This will be a little different, but I think the timing is critical. I think parties need to know enough ahead of time so you don't get in a place where people are, like you say, with a perishable product up against harvest time and don't know what they're going to be paid or what the options are for the parties. So.
After your follow-up.
In a related thing with the crab price, I was involved in that. Senator Mesley brought that forward. It worked fairly well. But over time, it's evolved that pretty much one company has the capacity. They also have the capacity to provide the market with the product because it's an ocean product. You don't grow it on somebody's land, so he can hold off negotiating, send his own boats out and take the cream off the top. You don't have that here. I don't think you do. I mean, how many buyers do you have that compete for those products?
Chair Clem, Representative Krieger. I think the growers can help me there in terms of how many buyers there are. I think there's at least 10 or in that range. I can't say it. I don't think there's a dominant one like there is in crab. And one of the things that even in that instance where I think this process has been helpful is that it does give the smaller buyers a say, more of a say than they otherwise would have in this sit down with the department and supervision of the process and the dialogue that goes on. There are some challenges there because of some concentration of parties, and we're trying to work through those. It's a very delicate balance in terms of, again, a voluntary process. We're trying to get the parties to the table. That's what we want to do. And so we don't want to be heavy-handed about it. On the other hand, we have to ensure that parties are acting in a way that's arm's length, good faith negotiations, and there aren't antitrust violations. So it's a balance. Yeah.
Thank you. Roland, did you have a question?
Nope, I'm good.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Clem. One of the concerns I've had over the years is the loss of cropland to berries, or berry crops, so to speak. And so one of the issues for me in this bill is this the instrument that would help the berry growers to keep them in business, so to speak? I realize there's nothing definite in that, but this should be helpful, I hope.
Chair Clem, Representative Van Orman, I'm sorry. I think this is a bill that the berry growers brought forward, and in all these cases, the growers have brought these bills through the legislature, and the department is the provider of the service. So we, again, it's a fee-for-service. We're there to provide the opportunity and the antitrust protection to the parties. And we hope, and I think we've seen this, that it can help stabilize prices over the long term. It does not, of course, erase market influences in this process. It helps to bring data to the table and, I think, help people make better decisions in terms of what they're planting, what's on the market. If we're in oversupply, growers need to think about, you know, maybe taking some acres out, and that's happened in the perennial ryegrass industry, for example. Significant acres have been taken out through this understanding and adjustment to market situations. So I think it helps those signals, and ultimately what we're talking about is price discovery. I mean, that's what this forum is, and it's going to happen one way or the other. Anyway, the intent here is to hopefully do that in a better organized fashion.
Okay.
I guess to your question, there is no guarantees. We certainly hope it helps, and we think it has in the other sectors.
Thank you.
And to make sure I understood something correctly, in the beginning you described the federal original act that allowed for the creation of co-ops, Capra Volstead. So is there, I'm just thinking about in the pear world, we don't need state action if we're already part of a grower co-op because of the federal act, because we already negotiate prices as a group under, you know, one brand, Diamond Fruit Growers in our particular instance. Is that, or did at some point someone create an exemption in state law too for us to be able to do that?
Chair Clem, there's, of course, both the Capra Volstead and a state cooperative law that provides antitrust protection for the growers. So growers can organize, yes, under those laws. They're protected from antitrust to be able to collectively pool their resources, discuss prices or market or process, whatever. The way the pears work and hazelnuts and so forth, you can bargain, but only with one buyer at a time, and that's the way pears are working. And generally, the bargaining entity will go to one buyer, try to get a price set there, and then go to the next buyer, and so forth. And they can do that without this process involved. But you can't sit down with more than one buyer, or the buyers get in trouble with antitrust protection.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what this process provides, is the buyers' antitrust if they sit down collectively with the growers.
And does that usually work out better when the buyers are also all talking to each other rather than the growers are just talking to each other and then picking one buyer off at a time?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I can answer that. I think there's different models out there. Different grower groups take different approaches. Some prefer the approach with the pears or the hazelnuts. And some prefer, as we're seeing in some commodities, the joint sit-down discussion with the whole industry or those who desire to participate. I've seen some studies that show a wide range of success or non-success with these processes. So, again, I'm not sure there's any guarantee one way or the other.
It seems like in a grower cooperative, growing, packing cooperative, marketing cooperative, you know, if you do those things together, you have a lot more control over things like, it's not control in the end, but you have a lot more flexibility over trying to get your grower members to shift crops around, reduce acreage. Here, I'm not sure if everyone really is only coming together just on the price question. You're not going to have a shared field person who comes around and, you know, talks about the shape of whether you're going to have more of a canning or fresh market variety. And that's, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just a price co-op almost,
right,
instead of a larger one that deals with quality and variety of other things.
Well, that raises another question in my mind because I have limited experience, as you can imagine, but my perception is that the berry growers seem to be exceptionally vulnerable to price fluctuation and sometimes at the mercy more than other growers, but that's only my perception, so I don't know if I made myself clear.
Perishability, too.
It is. It's a very vulnerable product. But it just seems over the years, you know, because I lived in Oregon City where berry crops were right up next against the city and Smucker's had a plant, you know, buying berries, and everybody was at the mercy of Smucker's around that area. So I don't know if that's a misperception on my part that the berry growers seem to be more vulnerable than most growers or if it's just every grower.
These nice berry growers have been sitting here waiting to talk. I should maybe
let them talk.
Why don't we ask you once you're done with your presentation? So, Leonard.
All right, thank you.
We're just talking about you. I know you're sitting right there. We're just talking about you.
No problem.
That's fine. Chair Clem, committee members, my name is Leonard Height. I have been a blackberry grower for 35 years. I am also executive secretary of the Blackberry Bargaining Association. Raising blackberries is a high-risk agriculture venture. It is also a very expensive crop to raise. Margins of profit are usually low or non-existent. The fruit is highly perishable and must be processed within a matter of hours. Once the fruit is received by the processor, the grower has virtually no control over the fruit. There are many growers, approximately 400, with about 6,000 acres of blackberries total. This means that most growers are quite small. 15 acres is an average. Because of this small size, no one grower has the ability or processing facilities to keep possession of their fruit. Many years the price for this fruit is not decided by the processor until well into the harvest season or until after the harvest is complete. Blackberries have been raised commercially for many years. I personally have been raising them for 35 years. During all these years, the growers have not had any input into the price they receive for their fruit. Because of the antitrust laws, growers have been prevented as a group from negotiating with processors for prices. Senate Bill 409 addresses these issues in a unique way. It allows growers to form associations to negotiate with all the processors at one time. This is done with Oregon Department of Agriculture supervision. It does not force anyone to participate, either growers or processors. Only those involved in the negotiations who come to an agreement will be bound by such an agreement. Thus, Senate Bill 409 allows a freedom for growers and processors to negotiate prices, something which neither has had in the past. We as growers want to keep this industry alive in Oregon, and we want it to be prosperous for us and for all of Oregon. Thank you. If you have questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
please.
My name is Wayne Boxler. I farm in the Mount Angel area, and I've been raising blackberries for about better than 25 years now. And I grew up in the berry field, so I kind of know the industry pretty good. And like's been said before, we are looking for the opportunity to possibly see if we can get into negotiation with more than one packer at a time, because right now it's illegal for more than for two packers to discuss basically the most everything about the industry, especially price and production. And that's kind of a roadblock, if you will, because right now we've got the pricing, we've got basically what the growers get is, if you will, the leftovers. If there's a downward push in the market, it directly goes to the grower. If you go into a season where you're either trying to discover the price during harvest or after, and then buyers are trying, or our packers, I should say, are trying to figure out how or what they're going to sell at what price to their buyers. And if the buyers decide that they would like to see a price at a different level, which is most usually on the lower side, if you will, where is that price going to change? It's going to change on the grower side. It's not going to be the packers. The packers have certain things that they have to meet, and our as a association, we all agree that if the packer's not there as a healthy entity, then we as growers don't have any, you know, we can't market our product. So one of the keys is to make sure that this bill, this system, is good for the processor as well as the grower. It's not, it can't be one-sided, and of course it's voluntary, so if it's not good for the packer, then why would they want to participate? But this gives us the ability to share information. I mean, that's the key. Right now, if we can get 3, 4, 5 packers in the room or more, 2 is a good start, more is better. We can move from there. Thank you.
Representative Shoffler. Thank you. I support your efforts here and the bill. In the 1922 Act passed by Congress at the federal level, did they just leave it open for the states to provide for this kind of process? Was it just left, and then I have a follow-up, was it just left open for us to do it or not at the state level? What was the language in there?
Chair Klamm, Representative Shoffler, this process called state action immunity is really developed over time. It's not spelled out in Capra-Volstead Act. That act is just for growers. You have to be a grower to be a member of a co-op, and that allows those grower members to draft bylaws to do whatever they want. These guys choose to just do pricing. So that state action immunity is developed out of court cases and Supreme Court language and some other legislation that says states can take certain actions to carve out these niches of antitrust if certain conditions are met.
Okay.
And that's what we're doing.
And
here,
may I, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
But it would still be illegal, according to federal law, for the buyers of these products to get together and collude,
yes,
before they go into the meeting with the growers.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Representative Shoffler, Chair Klamm, they can get together before if the department is there with them, so it's a kind of a pre-caucus, and we've done that with some of the other sectors. So if the buyers feel like they need to have a discussion before sitting down with the growers, we can facilitate that, but we have to be present as a state to make sure they aren't doing something illegal. And it's just like a caucus during the negotiation, but a meeting, you know, a meeting before.
All right. Thank you.
Yes.
Okay. I guess we're done with you three. Timothy Crater, Fede Amfilofiev. And Linda Strand.
Thank you.
Timothy.
My name is Timothy Creeder. I'm from Yamhill County. I've been a farmer all my life. I'm a third-generation farmer. I grew up on a strawberry and turkey farm. I raise blueberries. I raise over 7 different kinds of blueberries, 6 different kinds of blackberries. I would encourage you to help this bill, 409. I've been on the roller coaster of price negotiations, and it's something that I'd like to see modified. The fluctuations in price are very stressful at times. I've been a NORPAC cooperative member for 30 years now. I'm a member of the Ryegrass Bargaining Association, and when we plant our blackberries, it's very difficult to obtain a contract from a processor. And if we do get a contract, it's verbal or very loose contract. The price is not negotiated until well into our harvest. Yet we spend 22 months ahead of our harvest preparing for that. We make our economic decisions 22 months before we know what the price is going to be. And we'd like the opportunity to talk with our buyers, to have open and honest negotiations, to have conversations of free will where we can sit down and exchange information. And we cannot do that now. And as I've learned as I get older, that the more we keep information to ourselves, the more problems it is. The more open we can be discuss things, the more information we have, the better conclusions we can come to. And we're asking for basically collective bargaining. And we've found that to be fair, and we'd like to see that happen in this case. You know, the 6 different kinds of blackberries I raise, the majority of them are Sylvans. I do have Marions, I do have Boysons, Black Diamonds, Nightfalls, but you know, we're talking about all blackberries. You know, in wine, we talk about Pinot Noir because that's what the state is famous for. But in blackberries, we provide the United States with the majority of the blackberries, and we're good at it. And we would like to have the baby roller coaster instead of the big Oaks Park roller coaster. And I think that if we can discuss this with our processors and buyers, that we can find common ground that takes a little the high and the low out of it. We will still have supply and demand. We'll never get away from supply and demand. But if we can have information from our processors, if we can have more accurate information, and the sooner we can have this more accurate information, it provides a more stable environment for us. Thank you, Representative Clem. If there's any questions that I could answer, I'd be more than happy to. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Fadayan Filofyev. I raise in Woodburn and Brooks area, Marin County. I raise about 110 acres. About half of my crop is Boysons, a little bit of Marions. I have Black Diamond and Sylvan. And I've been farming with my dad for the whole lifetime, and about 5 years I already went on my own. And at first it was pretty good, but then it just, you know, how the prices would just keep on going up and down. And like about 2 years ago, I'm still paying for my fertilizer bill. Can't even finish paying it off, and hopefully the second year I'll be able to finish already. So it's been really hard on us. And out of my 3 brothers, I'm the youngest, and my oldest is he does it as a hobby. He's been doing it for about 8 years, but you know, on that bad year, he basically just sold everything, went out of business. And the brother that's a little bigger than me, well, older than me, the one in the middle, is basically just went out of business also. And it's just, I barely could survive on my own. I thought I'd never make it, and just little by little, just barely making it. And then me and my dad, we started driving around asking a lot of people, Russian community especially, and we just loved the idea. If we could like bargain with the cannery somehow, and then that's when I started driving around, and we get to know Leonard and Wayne, and then all of a sudden they just knew exactly how to start it, and from there this is where we're at now.
Thank you.
So if whatever has to be done, you know, we need to try something as for farmers to see if, you know, have it work or something. Thank you.
Linda.
Hi, thank you. My name is Linda Strand. I'm in Multnomah County, and I represent Columbia Empire Farms. Our farmland is in Newburgh, Dundee, and Sherwood. We raise blackberries and strawberries and hazelnuts. I was here last couple weeks ago accidentally because I thought I was here at the wrong day. So just a few of you recognize me. I was talking about the duck hunter. but I want to speak.
We're on this task force.
Yeah, that's right. And he, no, I won't take your time up today. I'll tell you later. I wanted to say that I'm real proud to be here with the farmers. I joined a farm about 14 years ago, Columbia Empire Farms. Prior to that, I had always been on the marketing side of Oregon products. I ran the Made in Oregon stores for 23 years, and I tried to encourage people to add value to their farm products and bring them and have an abundant supply for retailers. But what I found when I left Made in Oregon in 97 and joined Floyd Ayler and Bob Pamplin at Columbia Empire Farms was I was kind of thrown into the deep end of realizing that I didn't have any control over the crop price, and that was my role, was to figure out a way to take all of our crop and either sell it or add value to it. And at first, I was just so surprised that there was absolutely no way to kind of come together at the table. And slowly but surely over the years, we've been able to figure out how to add value. And I'm in a particularly unique situation from these other gentlemen farmers, who I also have the ability to process my crop. So I am actually a grower processor sitting here at the table, hoping that you will pass Senate Bill 409 because it helps. And this goes to exactly what Representative Van Orman asked. It helps create the stability so that this so that berries will be here in the future. I think that everybody here who's trying to work towards this bill passing is trying to have a berry crop in the future and not give it away to other countries. We'd like to have the local aspect of having the berries grown here, and it is it's just more challenging today than it's ever been to have a stable price. And I appreciate your reference to the roller coaster. I think that stability, we grow strawberries, and I had gone to a strawberry meeting about a year and a half ago about how to try and take, there were actual processors there. The person came from Häagen-Dazs ice cream, and he was trying to also encourage people to maybe even do a three-year contract. We were trying to kind of bring it up just in conversation because we couldn't really sit down and talk about it, but we were trying to talk to each other without being able to talk to each other. And I guess I don't know how else better to say it. I think the berry industry, the Blackberry Bargaining Association, is a positive step in having our industry be able to survive.
Questions? Representative Schaffler.
Only to say, my wife and daughter, they'd come home with flats of your products, and my daughter just eats them like candy. And I remember last summer, there were some real dark blackberries my wife bought. She's 15 and she's not totally self-conscious yet. And I walked downstairs and she's on the internet or something, and she just had black all about her face. I go, Marcella, I think you better go look in the mirror.
It
was so funny, though. Hey, don't talk about her mother like that. Anyway, but I do have a question. I have cherry trees, and last summer they didn't had a lot of flowers and very few cherries. I think my neighbor thinks it's because of the lack of bees pollinating the flowers. Have you run into that in your operations? The lack of bees. Do you have bees come and?
I know the gentleman next to me. Our farm has trouble with it. Yes, and we the pollinators are a huge aspect of what we do. And we run our own hives and have lost hives. It's a worldwide problem. Yeah. But I'll go ahead and play.
There is a problem with colony collapse disorder, and our beekeepers. I've hired a beekeeper out of Colton for the past 20 years. He didn't have a problem last year, but his neighbor did. This year he experienced 50% loss in his hives.
This year, yes.
So he runs a little over 1,000 hives. So he has to buy queens and split his hives and grow his hives back again. So, yes, it is a problem. And I've been in contact with the NRCS this year and to try and cooperate with native pollinators and plant insect areas around my fields and in my headlands, cooperating with the Xerxes Society to try and hold a workshop to figure out how we can help expand our insect populations, our predatory insects and our native pollinators to help reduce our insecticide use and use nature in the best form we can. But yes, the European colonized bee population has declined and we are fighting problems with that. So we're our scientists are ongoing and working on that ongoing problem.
Yeah, well, good luck.
Thank you, Chair Clem. Well, the interesting thing is that my neighbor had beehives and his collapsed. But I've noticed that there are some that have survived, and so I see them periodically, so I'm hoping that they'll colonize, but I'm not sure where they are, but I see them periodically.
Other questions?
Another question.
Okay. I had a thought, but I'll bring it back later, I think. I wonder about, I think it's a combination of marketing and negotiating, because the processors, I don't have a lot of fondness for the middleman, but you know, they have a job to do, and their issue, you know, is the marketplace too. And so unless you are into value added or other things that do some sort of market differentiation, they're going to be in a rough spot to give you a better price because they've got temptation factors to just buy it from somewhere else too. So this committee has done two bills, one of which passed the Senate 30-0 yesterday on having state government start trying to provide some market stability by purchasing more produce for prisons and letting county government do that. You know, and even if it costs more, still do it because you know, we have a difference, and the same thing applies to the Tillamook bill for timber. I mean, state's got a different role and obligation in providing stability for our natural resource industries than a middleman who's got to, you know, also sell at a profit, and we have a little bit different role. So hopefully we're helping, but I understand you'd like to negotiate in the private market with a little more collective bargaining, which is an unusual term to hear from farmers, I must admit.
Mr. Chair, I've been trying to avoid it, but if I may, because the cat's out of the bag now. I support this bill, and I agree that your collective bargaining efforts will, and I hope will, be successful for you. But if I were lobbying for the farm workers, I'd come right in here and I'd say, if collective bargaining is good for the growers, legislative action to help the growers, why shouldn't it be good for the workers too? So I just wanted to throw that out there, because it's a constant question in this building, in this state, and that's a hard answer. That's a hard question for some to answer, but it would not be for me. But now that it got brought up.
Well, if I remember right, I think Farm Bureau's position actually is, let's have collective bargaining laws, let's give it an exemption and do it. So it's an awkward reversal on that particular front.
Very awkward.
We don't mean to drag you into all of our problems. Sorry about that.
Mr. Chair.
I just want to make sure we're still the berry state.
Yeah,
me too.
Are we? I thought we were the beaver state. Representative Gilliam.
All good points, but we got a lot of people. We better keep moving.
And we do have a lot of ducks.
Ooh.
Look at this guy.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very steep.
Thanks.
Okay, we're down to our last two people, actually. Roger Beyer and Larry Dyke. If there's anybody who came in late that wants to sign up, this is the final two I've got on my list. And unless it takes an hour and 10 minutes, I think we're going to get through you two, but I'm not sure. I've got you first.
This was a 10 mile.
I know her really well.
Do you want to go first, Larry? I can divert from the order. It doesn't matter to me.
Let Roger.
Roger, you're first. Sorry, so you're on the list.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I signed up. I would anticipate to be last, just in case there's any unanswered questions that the growers weren't able to answer or anything like that. That's why I will just make a couple points that haven't been made yet. And I think I said my name, but just in case, I'm Roger Beyer and represent the Blackberry Growers Association, Blackberry Bargaining Association. In the Senate committee, when this bill came through, there was a processor who was not a grower processor, but just a processor, came and testified in support of the bill. And his statement was that he supports this bill because it would help him as he's going out trying to market his fruit if he knew what his cost of product would be. Under the current process, as it works, he's out there now trying to buy fruit and trying to market fruit, and he has no idea what his cost is going to be of the fruit. So it makes it very difficult for him as a processor and as a marketer, because he's working with an unknown. So that is why he, as a processor, supported the bill, or does support the bill, not supported. He continues to support the bill. The only other point I would make before I would just be here for questions is that if you recently saw in the Capital Press about 2 weeks ago that an abundance of berry juice, blackberry juice from, I believe it was Chile, but it was either Chile or Argentina, was dumped onto the market. These are the kind of things that these guys are facing with. The competition is not other states. It's a worldwide commodity now, as most fruits are. And they need to have a joint process so they can combat this worldwide economic condition when Chile or China or one of these countries just all of a sudden dump their excessive produce on the market. This will help them be able to plan for that and deal with that situation. So with that, Mr. Chair, and I would just, I shouldn't, but I will. He was looking at me. He goaded me into talking about it, collective bargaining. I would just remind Representative Schaffler that I supported the bill that allowed agricultural collective bargaining, and Governor Kitzhaber vetoed it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Oh, yeah.
And that is unfortunate, Roger. And I was just going to say, I'd rather be a farm worker in Oregon than a farm worker in China any day of the week. So I decided I'd share that with you, too.
Well said.
Okay. Any questions? Well, let's hear from Larry.
For the record, I'm Larry Dyke. I farm in Washington County. I raise cantata, blackberries, blueberries, grass seed, clover seed, beet seed, and wheat. Good morning, Chairman Clem and committee members. This bill presents many problems. Since we're talking about 10 to 15 different varieties of blackberries to be bargained for, you would need 10 to 15 bargaining groups in order for it to be fair, since all these berries are competing against each other. Otherwise, it'd be like a group of Bartlett pear growers establishing a price for Bosch or Anjou pears and telling those other growers, hey, that's just the way it is. I've thought about how to approach this bill, and have come up with three options, and any of them improve the bill, with option two being my first choice. The first option is to have a bargaining group for each variety, which is what I talked about. And the problems with that is having 10 or 15 different bargaining groups would be more than Brent would want, and also it'd be a big problem. Second option is the Blackberry Bargaining Group, a year ago, when they were putting this together, they presented their members a pricing plan. It was broke down into three categories. They priced it as early varieties, which were the Sylvans, the Marions, Black Diamonds, Cantatas, etc. The second pricing would be for Boysens. And the third would be for late varieties, the Chesters, Halls, Evergreens. Then, within each one of these groups, there would be a price set for the different grades for the IQF, Purée, and Juice. On the second page of my handout is a copy of what they gave us last year at the meeting, and also I have a copy of my sign-up sheet. I joined the bargaining since I do believe in the bargaining. But I believe the bargaining has to be set up in a way that will protect all berries, all growers. The third option that I have come up with would be for the bargaining group to only be for Marion Berries, since the Marion Berries seems to be the concern, that only make it for the Marion Berries. A problem that would, if it wasn't just for the Marion Berry, the problem would be the potential for backdoor deals. That the Marion Berry process, the Marion Berry pricing would sell the other berries down the road. To help prevent the backdoor deals, the legislation would have to specify that for Marion's only. Since I believe in bargaining, I belong to the ryegrass bargaining group, have for years. I would like to see the legislation for this bill include the handout, include the steps that they told us they were going to do. Because without that, I don't see that happening. And that's what they told the growers that they would do. They took our money, we signed up, would just like them to do that. I don't want this to become a Marion Berry pricing with a guess of all of it being for all the berries. We talked earlier about being a voluntary program, and I belong to the ryegrass. The ryegrass is a voluntary program also. But the problem you get into is when you have a bargaining group that's established in a price, even though if you're not a member, you're still subject to those prices. I haven't seen a processor yet, if a bargaining group establishes a price, that he's going to pay any more than what a bargaining group would come up with. They will set the prices. And unless they are required to do it, according to the way they said, by groups, I see many problems. Thank you.
Senator Shoffler.
Thank you. Roger, several weeks ago you talked to me about this. I support this bill. A couple things have come up. One is when the buyers caucus together with the department, and I should have asked this of the department, is that a public meeting? Are the minutes kept? Or is that confidential and private? That kind of, if I were a grower, that would make me a little uneasy. Do you know how this process is going to work on that side of it? And then I have a follow-up, please, too.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shoffler, I am not familiar. You'd have to ask Brent that question exactly on those caucus meetings. I know the full bargaining meetings, they are public and minutes are kept. But as far as the end of it, because the growers are allowed to caucus also, and I don't know if those are public or private meetings. But the department is there.
Okay, as long as it's balanced out, I guess I can, because then they can talk among themselves. Mr. Dyke here, I hope I'm pronouncing your name right.
That's correct.
Raised some interesting questions. Is there anything stopping or preventing these conversations and negotiations from in these bargaining sessions from specifically setting a price on each individual berry, or will it be one price for all the berries? Or could it be a combination? How does all this work? Just so I know exactly what I'm voting for today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Shoffler, members of the committee. This bill has been drafted with the term blackberry and very vaguely asking the department to set by rule what is included in that that definition of blackberry. That was done on purpose because, as with any other agricultural commodity, you see over time varieties change. What may be the popular variety today may be replaced by something next year, next week, 10 years from now, by another variety that is a better fruit. So if you were to name specific varieties in the bill, it would not allow for that. So that's why we set it up by rule. Mr. Dyke brought up some interesting things. This bill does allow for multiple associations. This bill does not speak to an association. This bill speaks for any association. There could be 10, 15, 20 different associations formed if growers so choose. Or an association can form that covers all blackberries and represent that way. It's up to the association. It's up to the group. But remember, the group of growers, the association, can only bargain for what the processors will agree to bargain for. So whether you have 10 associations or each representing a single variety, or one association representing all varieties, you can only talk about what the processors are willing to talk about. And remember that, like this association, like any association, they are controlled by their members and by their boards. They have bylaws. They have to follow their bylaws. Their bylaws are filed, you know, with the state like any other association is. So the way you affect the process of an association is to join the association, get on the board of the association, and which I happen to know that this association has membership available and also has board positions available for people who are willing to work inside the association and craft how you want your association to work. That is the way the process would work.
And one more, Mr. Chair, and then I'll shut up. And just so you know, Roger, I'd passed a note down talking about collective bargaining before the words were said, and I told my friend here that I wasn't going to say anything about it. And then the words were said, and you know where my heart is. And I, but once again, I did not mean to come in here bring that up. And I wish that that bill had been signed, because it may not have given everybody everything they wanted, but it would have been a beginning of a process and the very same process I think we're starting here. And our good friend, the grower, I think really said it well. Sitting down and sharing information from people that have different interests is a great way to get something accomplished. And that's a problem in this building, too. People don't sit down enough and talk about their differences or their ideas. And when you don't do that, then you got nothing but pain. And I wish that bill had passed, because I think we'd be a lot farther along in stability in that area than we are now if it had. So I did not mean to jump all over you on that one.
Representative Roblin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank you on pointing out the idea that berries change over time, and
right.
it is good to have statutes that are flexible to deal with it. And my favorite berry growing up, because there was a big plant in our neighborhood, was the Loganberry, and I hardly even find it anymore, and it's still my favorite pies ever were always from that plant. So I get frustrated that somehow we got to switch it around again and get back to some of those other berries. But I think that the only way you can make good legislation is to make it flexible enough to deal with the changing markets. And I think that, I hope that the stuff that was agreed to that Mr. Dyke talks about is carried out. I mean, I don't see any reason why it wouldn't be. But I think the same thing, that if you put that stuff in and things change, it makes it impossible to make the next adjustments you have to do. So I'll hope that the group can get together and make sure that they negotiate those separate prices appropriately. And I appreciate the bill. So, again, thanks, and keep working on Loganberries when you're out there in your bureau.
I'll do that.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I belong to the bargaining, the ryegrass bargaining. Now there's a fescue bargain, like Brent said earlier. But when you have the ryegrass bargaining, there's probably 100 varieties of ryegrass.
Right.
And all varieties of ryegrass are priced the same. The bargaining group negotiates one price. All those varieties aren't necessarily equal value. I mean, you have newer varieties, older varieties. Newer varieties, boy, they're the greatest. They want those. The older varieties, they'll mix those, make a blend. Anyway, these berries, this is a totally different thing. We have these different varieties of blackberries that are competing for the same thing. And if you have a... Right. You know, right now, Marion's are about 46% of all the blackberries, okay? But the people that are on the bargaining group are primarily Marion berry growers, or they raise Marion berries. They may raise other berries, but they all, I believe, have some Marion berries. So the situation is different, you know? We don't have one price for all berries. We're going to have different prices for different berries. And a bargaining group for each. I've talked to Brent about this. Brent, he's told me, and you can ask him. I mean, Brent said he would be fine with going with a breakdown of early Boysen's late varieties, but there's no way that him or the department are going to get into, you know, that many, 10 or 15 different bargaining groups. That's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. So anyway, I believe this breakdown is a manageable thing that would be able to, and would protect everybody. Without that, I'm just afraid that we're going to have, you know, one interest being representative. And yeah, we can all join, but one person, one representative for the state of Oregon, you have one voice
against everyone else, and it's and it's not an easy process. Then, is it, Representative Gilliam?
No, it's Representative Schaffler.
And that's what I'm saying, and that's my point: is that one voice does not carry the weight. Now, I raise about 1.25% of all the blackberries in Oregon. Okay, is what I raise. You know, not a big number. Like Leonard said earlier, it's 400 growers. Most of them are fairly small. But in order to represent all the berries fairly, I believe there has to be some type of grouping. And like I say, this is what they presented to us, to the membership, on what they would do.
What is the problem, Roger, with at least early and late varieties, and then let the agency spell out and rule which things are early and which are late, because that's going to be a forever category. I mean, it's just the way nature works. Some are early, some are late.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, are you asking what would be the problem with putting that in the bill,
yeah,
that you have to, yeah, negotiate a different price for early and late varieties?
No. Just that those are categories of things. Well, you know, because you can't know whether you're going to negotiate a different price. I mean, you don't know what the processor's going to say. It might be the exact same price in early or late. So you wouldn't say that, but you would say you would negotiate early varieties and late varieties. You wouldn't be able to preclude what the price would be.
Mr. Chair, I guess the main thing I see is again, a statute is by design in Oregon, because we have administrative rule process. The statutes are, I believe, in my opinion, best left generic and let the rules define that. I think it would be extremely appropriate for the Department of Agriculture to put that in their rules. So then as things change over time, those rules are flexible. You don't have to come back here every 2 years to reopen the statute if, for some reason, something changes.
Precludes them.
If you put it in statute that you have to negotiate separately for early season varieties versus late season varieties, and nobody wants to negotiate for one of those, have you violated statute then?
Oh, you'd violate rule if you didn't rule too then.
But rules are much easier to change, is my point, Mr. Chair.
Mm. So. Yeah, I kind of like it myself. Representative Schaffler.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would encourage the department to be sensitive to this, and not, clearly the berries, there's not every berry is the same, and I have some sympathy to what Mr. Dyke's saying, and I think this could be worked out without amending this bill. And I think 2 years from now we're going to find out if it was worked out without amending this bill, because we'll have Mr. Dyke right here before us saying it's exactly what I predicted if what he says does come true. So I would encourage the department to be flexible in this.
Yeah, and I'm more of the flexible part. And the other thing for me is, if you start having a discrepancy between the two that's fairly great, I contend that you'll find new varietals of the same berries are late and early. So maybe Marion berries are early or whatever. I'm not sure right now.
Early.
But it's easy to, not easy, but there are people out there working every day on varietal kinds of berries and so on and so forth. And pretty soon you'll move a different kind of Marion berry that's late if it makes. I mean, I just. Those are what market conditions do, and I think these berries naturally are early or late, but that doesn't mean that they will continue to be early and late over time. You'll find one that comes out a little later and later, and pretty soon you're breeding. I mean, I watch what's happening in all these different kinds of things. So I like the idea of having it in rural as opposed to deal, because you're going to have new things, and it might become another one that's even totally different.
Yeah,
it doesn't meet either of those categories, and you don't have any place to put it, so what do you do? So I appreciate the idea of rule.
My vice chair reminds me wisely we're evolving into a work session, which we're not doing today, so we have no revenue impact statement. Larry, did you want to make one final response?
Yeah, one final response. Like I say, part of it gets to be promotion and marketing. You know, if you have a bargaining group and or a commission that promotes a certain berry, and right now the commission certainly is promoting Marion berries. They promoted the Marion Berry Pie Contest at the Oregon State Fair this last summer, and no other berries, it was Marion berries. Well, I had a friend of mine bake a pie from Alicatadas and entered in the contest, and it took third place. Okay? So the Cantata pie took third place. But I guarantee you, you talk to any Marion berry grower or berry grower, you know, because Marion berries have a distinct flavor, distinct taste. They're a completely different berry. I challenge that.
Berry pie scandal at the fair. Yep. Man, this is really good.
Who are the judges?
The governor was one of the judges.
No wonder. That explains everything.
Also some members of the Berry Commission.
Oh, and processes.
You don't know left from right either.
This is great.
Where's Mitch Lees when we need him?
Oh, man. All right.
Rips on fire.
You know, coming in at the tail end of this, I just wanted to say that I like Marion Berries, but I never make my pies out of just Marion Berries. I always mix my berries, whether it's Boysen and Marion or, we have a lot of really good berries in the state. And
Boysen is certainly, like I say, in this pricing group, Boysens are a distinct one because they are, you know, they're not an early, I mean, they're just totally different than the early and late varieties.
Yes, they are.
Now, one thing that that I want to share is my experience is if you have an association that starts to lead towards one particular variety, it can have a real impact on your operation. We had a situation 2 years ago where the co-op said, hey, we really think the consumers are going to go with this Stark Rimson. You need to kind of tear out your red Bartlett's here shortly. And that was not cheap, nor fun or good or anything else. And so that's the problem if it ends up like in the cranberry situation you mentioned, where a particular variety seems to, not through any nefarious scheme, but through consumer preference, it seems to do it. It's hard on the grower. So I have great concern for the having to replant something else. Now, the worst thing is then all of a sudden, 2 years later, after they're ripped out, the co-op came back and said, you know, actually, we're not so sure about that.
Jeez.
Oh, it's like, well, okay, we just tore out 200 trees, and they said, well, we're not sure. Actually, the red Bartlett seems to be making a little comeback. And that was not good. What am I going to do about it? So, and I think your choices, we had this on apples, your choices, our co-op decided apples just aren't going to be worth it, so they took out the packing line. So now there's no line at all anymore. So then it's okay, you can drive it over to Bingen if you want, 30 miles, and you're getting a cent and a half a pound. You just pay the guy 1.2 cents a pound to pick it. And my father-in-law just said, go dump them in the orchard. I'm sick of this. And that was because our co-op took out our packing line because they all decided, now we're going to do better in cherries or pears because for some reason the apple prices due to imports or whatever, you know, people like apples, but it wasn't Red Delicious either. It was a good apple, a tasting apple. I know people hate Red Delicious now. But those are the problems the growers face directly with the marketplace, but also their co-ops or their processors can cause problems by making an incorrect guess at what's going to happen, and then they kind of twist you to take out acreage or you know, switch your acreage around, graft something on in the tree fruits, and it is an issue. It really is.
And certainly it can be just a fact that our legislators pass a law, and then it goes into the hands of a group that push it one direction. Like I say, I'm all in favor of bargaining. I'm in favor of the bargaining group, but just make it the bill so that it specifies it does what they said they were going to do. That's all I ask.
All right. Anything more for today? This one? Okay. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 409 and open a work session on Senate Bill 187. I believe we've got some amendments to discuss. Maybe the author would like to walk us through. Do people need a refresher on the underlying bill first? It's the bill that deals with what happens when there's a refund or where there's an amount sitting in an account at Department of Ag, and the discussion was that it cost them 30-some dollars to process it, and right now if it's under $5, then they... So if it's under $5, they may refuse to do the refund, and this bill would take that up to $25 rather than $5. The cost is $31.45, and we have two amendments as choices from Representative Wingard that I'll let him discuss. Are they both yours?
Yes, they are.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Dash 1 amendments would simply direct the Department of Ag to send those overpayments to the Division of State Lands as unclaimed property. The Dash 2 amendments would require them to credit the overpayment forward to next year's application. And what it says very clearly is if the person doesn't reapply, then they do get to keep it. But that if they do come back for a renewal of their license, they get credit on their overpayment towards their license. I would hope the committee would adopt one or the other. I think simply allowing the department to keep the overdraft just doesn't sit well. But obviously, others may disagree.
Mr. Shoffler?
Do we want a motion from one? Does the chair have a preference?
Well, I just saw him for the first time, and we don't have fiscal, so we couldn't do motions without rule suspension. I probably want to hear from the department their opinion on the amendments.
Yeah. Okay.
You can.
Can we suspend rules, though, Mr. Chair? Would you intend to suspend the rules today?
I don't have a strong preference one way or the other. If we like, we actually have the votes for the amendments, but I think we need to hear from the department first. I know one of them will not end up saving any money, I think. That was the concern about that one.
For the record, Lisa.
Staff time, not money, staff time.
Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Department of Ag. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we just looked at the amendments this morning as well, although we have discussed some of these options with members individually in preparation for a work session on the original bill. In terms of the unclaimed property, the Dash 1 amendments, the department looked into this option, and the staff time and the cost of doing the work to move this over there for the minimal amount that we're talking, $25 or under, it doesn't save the staff time that we had hoped to with this amendment. This really was an amendment or a bill about efficiency. And I think to give you just a little more sense of what we were trying to get to, I did some quick math. During the last biennium, 05-07, the department issued 2,400 total refunds in an amount of $432,000. Now, of those, 500 of them were for amounts $25 or less. So 20% of the work for 1.5% of the cash value of the refunds. And so this, for the agency, this really was about regaining staff time and putting that back towards customer service. So the Dash 1 amendments, generally in terms of that staff time, we don't regain that. And we already, for unclaimed property, we follow these unclaimed property statutes for checks that aren't cashed, et cetera, within the agency. With the Dash 2 amendments, these would allow for the dollars to carry forward and then be applied to a future license. One of the challenges, many of these operations change from year to year. This would allow at some point in the future for those dollars to go back to the program. However, with that, our current systems, our electronic systems, don't track it in a way. And again, there would be cost associated with this for such a small value in terms of the refund. Again, the whole intent of this was around efficiency and cost savings. And without going back and doing the math on this amendment, I would guess there will be a significant fiscal impact to make the changes in the system. Just another point on this, any of these monies go back into the programs for which those fees were paid. And so the cost right now that we have in excess of issuing these refunds costs other fee payers more in terms of running those programs longer term. I hope that's clear, because the programs, these fee-for-service programs, have to they recover their costs.
Mr. Chair.
Question for Representative Sharpe.
Okay, well, in the future, will this amount of money, this area where you get this money of less than $25 not being sent back, will you keep track of that and account for that and come and report to us how much that amount is in case it were to grow into some substantial amount over the years? I know you're not going to build it up over the years, but let's say a larger, that 1.5%, if that grew to 10%, Now you're talking about a substantial amount of money. And I just, I mean, God bless the department, but I just don't want to just forget about this. So I would like to know, keep track of how much this is over the years, so it doesn't grow into a substantial amount of money, because then I think my colleague down there would have a point in not just have it, a nice little fund to dabble with, it, which would rather irritate me. So there you go.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, we can easily do queries of these amounts on the payment system, because that's how we pulled the numbers, and if you would like some report back and for us to monitor that, we can address that.
I guess this is probably for Representative Schaffler, because I'm thinking in terms of having paid the incorrect amount, is that for me, being as cheap as I am, I would want to be sure that I paid the correct amount. So if this were implemented, I would hope that people would know that if you're over $25 or under $25, that the department will not refund. So I'm not sure if I have a question in there or not.
We had some conversation around making clear on the application forms some language that would make it obvious, if, you know, when you're filling out your application, you would see it on the paper,
yeah,
unless you just don't read everything, which happens. Didn't we talk about that a little bit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Van Orman. So as part of this, prior to bringing this proposed legislation forward, the department went through an extensive process through the Regulatory Streamlining Program at looking at our licenses and our license applications to try and streamline those and make them easier for people to fill out. We have a variety of ways that people pay license and registration fees. And for example, in the nursery program, it's paid on gross annual sales. So there are if, then, but, that's, and percentages that need to be multiplied, and that's where we have had issues. In addition, in our brand inspection program, where it's a onesie-twosie counting thing, those tend to show up. Representative Krieger had asked us specifically, is this happening in one program? And I have a query that's about this thick that shows it's all over the agency, but our efforts on the streamlining side of this to try and make our forms more clear to the users when they submit those, and easier to do the math. We currently are not, just so that I'm clear, communicating back to those individuals when they've overpaid $5. If it's $5 or more, they get a refund. If it's under $5, that goes back into the program funds.
Could you had said something to me somewhere about how many staff hours you thought that would be saved.
Let me see. It was in our previous testimony. Yeah. And we estimated that each one of these refunds takes, I believe it's about an hour of staff time. Yeah, 1 hour of staff time for each one of these refunds that's under 25, well, in this case, whichever way, under the threshold amount.
But so over five, so under the bill, over five but under 25.
I'm sorry.
There's 500 hours worth of work that now won't have to be done because they were over five but under 25?
Okay. So let me give you another breakdown that'll help you, maybe. During last biennium, there were 55 refunds that were $5 and under. There were 257 refunds done from $5 to $10. There were...
How much was that?
257.
257.
From
5 to 10. From 10 to 15, there were 72. From 15 to 20, there were 145. And from 20 to 25, there were 28.
So you add up the 257, 72, 145, 28, and that's the...
And we should end up with 500
yeah.
of
okay.
$25 or under.
Gilliam and then to Schaffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for remembering me.
I'm just trying to add up the half an hour's worth of time in making you wait that amount, and then we'll be back to even.
Great practical example. Thank you. The integrity of returning people's money is protected in the Dash 1s, but I agree with Lisa that it repeats, in a way, what I think the department's trying to get at. So I was hoping that the number 2s, Dash 2s, were a little more elegant, but I appreciate your caution, although we don't know what it is, that it could be more. I guess one of my questions is it appropriate or legal for a department to take the float on money should it become, as my colleague suggested, something significant? Is there a opportunity here for the department and an opportunity for us to have the integrity of forwarding the money and returning it? And the last part, I guess, goes to the representative, is this is vague in its language of when you would, how long you would carry that forward, isn't it?
No, actually, it makes it clear in here that they hold it until the renewal date for the whatever the fee is. So, and that's the date at which, if the person hasn't renewed, then they get to keep the money that they were holding to carry forward for the next payment. So, and it says the person. So, if I pay a fee and I overpay by $24, then they'll hold that until whatever it was I paid the fee for, the license, or that is about to expire. And then on the day at which I was supposed to renew it, if I renew it, I get the 24 credit. If I do not, if I let it lapse and then come back later, then I've lost the money.
Follow up. I really don't have one. I was just to annoy him. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, if you have the paperwork to pass in or underlying bill today, I'm willing to pass it out and vote for it today. But my question is, and Lisa, I haven't looked at the department's budget, but if there's any general fund money in your budget, we should calculate the hourly rate times 500, take that out of your budget, and put it into providing some kind of health care for people with your efficiency, diligent efficiency.
It would come out of food safety, which is kind of a health care issue right
now.
Representative Van Orman.
Well, it's interesting. I think, one, it sounds like Dash 1 is a time consumption issue that is not going to be resolved. And Dash 2 is an accounting issue that the system is not set up to account for that kind of a process. And so in order to do that would require additional purchase of software, I would assume, to provide the accounting service that you would need to do it. So either way, it defeats the original, both of them defeat the original purpose of the bill. So I think those are the questions that we have to resolve.
And before she responds, Mr. Chair, this money, this activity spent on the fee payers are paying for this, so it wouldn't have anything to do with the general fund. In light of my joking comment earlier.
Chair Clem, Representative Schaffler, you're correct.
Right.
The fee payers are paying for this, and the fees go back into the programs for which those funds were collected. And for the cost currently in excess of what we're refunding, which is, well, if I do quick math, I think it's about $8,000 last biennium, the fee payers are paying for that additional cost in terms of time. Because
so the money is used to offset, to reduce the subsidy the current fee payers are going to pay to the person who's getting the refund. Yeah. Representative Roebling.
Mr. Chair, I guess it's more of a comment. But we are in a work session, so that's good. I like the twos with regard to, I agree it's a more elegant. Having worked on House Bill 2500, and recognizing how bad the interactive capacities of our computer systems are from agency to agency, it's clear to me that we have a lot of work to do, and I would hope that as we improve our network ability and our software, that we will include in our software conversations the ability to easily put this as a carry forward to the next time so that it becomes something that doesn't cost money. Because I agree it probably would right now. So I'm in favor of, moving the original bill. But I would certainly like to see, as we build these systems, that we think about these kinds of deals so that in the future they come back to us and say, we are now ready to go back, and we will automatically put this, you know, we'll assign a number to the to each of the people who are doing this, you know, getting the deals, and then this will be assigned to it so it just pops up next time the deal says they owe X number of dollars. I think that there are ways that this can happen, and there are systems that are working today. I agree with right now the way it is, it would cost us more money than it provides, and therefore the other people who are ratepayers are going to have a chance to have their rate pay increased because we're refunding money, which doesn't make any sense right now. But in the future, I really hope that we develop systems that make this something that isn't a difficult deal. When they're entering it, they just automatically tag it to that person. So that would be my suggestion.
Representative Winger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lisa, you stated that it takes an hour of staff time to issue the refund. Could you just walk the committee through what that hour is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, I have Lauren Henderson here in the room who knows that exactly, and he had to go to another meeting. But there is, and so I'm going to give you a shell of an answer, and if you want it broke down specifically, I will be happy to go back and have staff do that for you. There's the time within the licensing program. There are the checks and balances in terms of the oversight of this and having things signed off within the programs. There is the time of reentering it back into the system to have the checks issued and the costs of having the checks issued. And so all of that adds up to about a combined hour of staff time. It's not a single person. It's bits and pieces of multiple people throughout the checks and balances.
Mr. Chair.
Are you okay for the moment? Representative Gilliam.
Why is it so hard to be efficient?
Well,
because I think that's the department's motivation, and I know it's Representative Wingard's motivation, but that's just a comment. It's just not as simple as it looks.
I was thinking if we were in Ways and Means right now, Senator Walker would have already scoffed at the hour per and dragged everyone through every second of it to explain how it does not take an hour to hit print on a refund thing. So I'm glad we're not in Ways and Means right now because we don't have to go through that.
Hear, hear.
Representative Krieger.
Referring back to Representative Roblin, getting the technology in line is the first time you do it, and after that it's in place, and those costs are not going to be incurred year after year once you've done it. So, yeah, the upfront cost would be there of having a system be able to do that and become more efficient, but it doesn't continue year after year.
Correct. All right, I think I'm ready to take a motion.
Mr. Chair?
Oh, sorry, Representative Wingard.
We are in a work session?
We are in a work session, though the motion I'm looking for is the underlying bill.
You recognize me?
No.
Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair?
You want to vote on it, we can.
I would like to take it.
That's fine. Representative Wingard.
Mr. Chair, I would move the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 187.
Representative Wingard moves the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 187. Discussion?
I got one comment on
Representative
that.
Representative Gilliam.
I just wish there was a way. I like the -2s. I wish there was a way in the bill, and we're going to move on. But maybe just by friendly directive for the department to, at the minimum, explore this carry forward idea without just saying do this to the entire group that comes in, but just how hard is it? I think the caution is a good one, but we really don't know how many hours it would take. And what if IS came down and said, oh, this is easy to do, we did this for Nordstrom, we put a balance forward and you take it from there. If that was, and maybe I'm dreaming, if that was efficient, I think it would be good. It would be the classic win-win.
Well, just, I'm sorry, stand with these for one moment.
Positive. Is the motion usually is to suspend the rules in order to discuss?